Welcome to another episode of the Spoon Mob Podcast. This week I'm joined by sommelier and beverage and wine director Peter Van Der Riep of Bar Gobo in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I first learned about Peter through Jayton Paul, who's a previous guest on this podcast, a handful of episodes back. But I learned about him through Jayton because Jayton did that Best Sommelier of Canada competition, and Peter did it the year before him. So Peter was the BC Sommelier of the Year a year before Jayton was. And so I felt it'd be a nice compare and contrast across kind of the two episodes. I'm getting a feel for how that kind of program has evolved and everything like that. And I wanted to have Peter on to talk about his experience going through the competition and everything, as well as kind of his career and whatnot. Was able to reach out and get him on the podcast, and you get kind of a nice balance of, you know, Jayton talked in depth about learning another language and going through the competition. Peter talks about his experience too as well. It was at the Rogers Center, which is where the Vancouver Canucks play. It's a hockey arena in downtown Vancouver. So going through that, learning French, he's still participating in the competition today, kind of the rules and regulations surrounding that too as well. And how he found his way from kind of going through geology when he was in college to working at a coffee shop to eventually, you know, managing the wine program at Bar Gobo in Vancouver, which is part of Burdock & Co.'s kind of restaurant group. So really fun episode, just kind of a nice compare and contrast between, you know, previous guests and this episode, kind of how they both approach wine, how they wound up in the situations that they did, even being recognized by the same institutions, receiving the same awards, winning the same competitions and everything, but just two different approaches to it. So I felt it'd be pretty awesome, you know, to have kind of those two ends of the spectrum so people can kind of listen to both episodes and see the differences and hear the differences and everything. But you can follow Peter on Instagram. It's at Peter_VAN. You can also follow the restaurant bar that he works at, Bar Gobo, which we get into about kind of how he curates the wine list and everything. That is at bar.gobo, G-O-B-O. You can follow us on Instagram. We're at Spoon Mob. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, all that stuff. It's either at Spoon Mob or at Spoon Mob 1, depending on the platform. Primarily, we do everything through Instagram. There's a recent update with Instagram. It's changed a few things again. It's pretty annoying, but we just kind of push through it. But you can find us there too as well. Check out the website, spoonmob.com. You can write in questions, comments, feedback. You can view all the pages that we have for all of our guests, links to their individual episodes. If they've been on more than once or if they've only been on once, it'll take you directly to it. Food photos from our time at their restaurants, or wine photos from wine that we've been recommended by them or gotten through their wine shop or what have you. You can find all that stuff there too as well. You can also follow us on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel. It's just at Spoon Mob on YouTube. So youtube.com/SpoonMob will take you right there. You can hit follow, subscribe. Any podcast platform you can find us too as well. We're just at Spoon Mob. Should be a white and orange logo, and you can follow, subscribe to the podcast there. All new episodes will hit your feed. Thursdays, 1 a.m. Eastern time is when most of our episodes drop. Sometimes there might be a delay because of editing or what have you, scheduling, whatnot. It might come out at 8 or 9 a.m. that Thursday morning, but we target 1 a.m. on Thursdays, kind of weekly episode releases for now. But that's going to change in a couple weeks, but I'll go into detail on kind of the aspect of that in the mailbag episode that's upcoming. But that's kind of it for the updates and everything. So without further delay, here's my conversation with sommelier and beverage wine director Peter Van Der Riep of Bar Gobo in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast and taking some time out of your day here to jump on and talk about your career and wine and everything. So first learned about you through Scout Magazine and Jamie Ma, who we've had on this podcast a couple years ago. Kind of follow what he's doing there. He's a big proponent of kind of the Vancouver food and wine scene, and he's been doing his podcast, and I know you were on there. And then kind of also we had Jayton Paul on, who you, a year before, were the BC Sommelier of the Year, which I want to get to and everything. So you kind of passed the torch to him, so to speak. And I want to get to kind of all that, what you're doing now and everything too. But how did you kind of first get involved with wine? I mean, you have like a geology degree, right? So like, how did that wind up taking you down the world of wine?
I don't know, wine was always kind of around my family a little bit. I mean, not as much as if I were probably Italian, but the wine was always kind of on the Sunday dinner table. I have an uncle who collected Bordeaux back when I was, he still collects. So there was always kind of wine books, wine maps, wine labels all over the place. And I had an interest in it when I was at boarding school. I started an illicit wine tasting club with a few buddies of mine that we weren't supposed to do, of course, because we were underage, or some of us were underage. And then I didn't really drink a lot during university, at least not wine-wise anyway, until my third year when I joined my university's wine tasting club, which I took over for my fourth year, and I kind of got into wine a little more seriously then. I thought I knew everything then. I learned that was not the case. And I kind of piqued an interest in my last year of university. I took UBC Wine Science as an elective, which everyone thinks is a fluff course. And it's not. It's actually quite a bit of chemistry and difficult geography and stuff like that. After taking that and realizing there weren't a lot of prospects for me after graduating in my field, at the wrong time in the economy, I got a job locally. I wanted to stay in Vancouver. And as a lot of stories go for people in my industry, you know, they start as a dishwasher somewhere. I worked at a coffee shop for a few years. I was really into coffee. And after a while, got more interested in the restaurant side of things.
What was like your original career path that you were kind of venturing down, you know, getting the degree in geology? Because I think when people hear geology, all they hear is like, oh, did you want to go be an archaeologist and dig up dinosaur bones? Like, so what did you want to do with that degree? Like, where were you headed kind of originally before obviously graduating and realizing that everything was terrible for everybody at that time?
I didn't intend on doing geology when I went to school. I was in biology initially, decided I hated it. It was all full of pre-med students who, the department treated you like a number, and it was just like a mill to churn out doctors, and most people hated what they were doing as students. So I took, I guess a lot of things started with an elective for me. I took the classic Rocks for Jocks course because my dad was a geologist, and that's kind of what I, you know, I was like, oh, maybe I can talk to my dad more about geology if I take this course. And then I scored the highest in the class, and so the department started actively recruiting me. I was like, well, this department seemed all right. So, and I like the science. Geology is a little more creative than a lot of other sciences because you're kind of predicting what's underground. But I was intending on being a petroleum geologist. So I'm from Calgary, Alberta, which is kind of like the Houston of Canada. And so lots of oil and gas. And the idea was to be a geologist where I'd work in an office, actually. It was like, you know, you're doing a lot of analysis of subsurface work and telling guys how to drill holes to try and find, for me, it was mostly natural gas, but that was the original plan. Go work for some company and find gas and make some money. But no one was hiring in 2009.
When you wind up at the coffee shop, Elias and Coffee, what led to you working at a coffee shop? Was it just need something to do and they were hiring, or did you actually like have an active interest in coffee at that time?
Yeah, I had an active interest for sure. I would say it kind of ties in a little bit to my whole story of my personal journey of flavor and taste. When I was a kid, like my first experience with coffee would have been like, or fancier coffee would have been Starbucks in the like late 90s. I kind of figured there was something that would taste better out there. Like, what tastes better than this? Like, this is expensive. This is what people think is fancy. But surely there's something better than this multinational corporation, even though they're pretty small back then. And so I kind of started seeking out better tasting things. And the coffee scene was very small at that point. Definitely in Calgary, and it was just starting across a lot of North America, not like it is now. I kind of kept on seeking out better and better coffee shops, like who's doing better, what's like, what is the deal with coffee and flavor. So when I moved to Vancouver, I got a job at a cafe immediately. Like, I think I landed and I had a job within 12 hours at like the best, one of the best coffee shops in Vancouver. And I worked there during my university degree. So I had connections locally in the coffee industry. So the Legion was like the top for me. It's where I kind of hung out in school, just drinking a lot of espresso, a lot of coffee. I emailed the owner there. I was like, hey, I think you guys are hiring. Do you want to take me on? He was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So I was working at the university at the time, and my profs miscalculated the grant funding they had because they're not mathematicians. And so they had to let me go earlier than the term that I thought I had. It was all probably horribly illegal, but I was young and dumb and had some leases that I needed to pay for my apartments. And so I needed a job right away, and that's where Elysium came in. I left geology and immediately started hospitality. I think I had one day off in between, and behind me now, yeah, it was a crazy time of some fast decisions that really significantly affected the rest of my career.
When you move into the hospitality space, like, did you have a plan? Like, when you wind up working at the coffee shop and everything falls through with the university, did you ever have the thought of, oh yeah, well, you know, the hospitality industry is somewhere where I could be, or that's something that I enjoy? Or did it take a while before you got to that point?
I wanted to work as a geologist for like 10 years, make some money, put some money aside, and then open up a little cafe. So that's just kind of the working for 10 to 15 years and owning my own thing. But I mean, initially it would have been to work just for a few months and then try to move back to Calgary and figure things out from there. But Vancouver is a very appealing place to live, so I didn't feel like going back to the winters of Alberta. And so I figured out what I could to try and make rent in Vancouver on a meager barista salary. But yeah, you kind of do what you need to do when you're young and pretty like fiercely independent. So I didn't want to, you know, look for help or assistance anywhere. So I just kind of put my head down and worked. And probably looking back, I was probably a little bit, I was pretty green in some ways. You know, when you're young and you think you have all these ideas and you think you're right, probably would have changed how I do things now. But it was a good time. It was a fun 2.5 years working full time as a barista. A good shot. Lots of talk about flavor and stuff like that.
At any point in that like 2.5, 3 years time period, did you think like coffee was going to be kind of your thing? You know, because eventually you move on into kind of the space of wine and cocktails and bar management. But did you think being, whether it was a coffee, you know, sourcer or manager, or eventually, like you mentioned, kind of an owner of a potential shop down the road, was kind of if you went the geology path? But did you think that you would stay in the world of coffee, or did you know that you would kind of move on to something else?
Coffee was possibly the be all end all for me. I looked at roasting or cube grading, which is like the equivalent of, well, I actually don't even know if there's an equivalent. It's kind of like a hybrid wine making, wine buyer thing, or like, yeah, more serious business stuff. There's not a lot of money in coffee, I don't think. I mean, if you hit it right, I think there is, but when you're a small independent coffee business, there's not much beyond a few, not a lot of roles in a small roaster. And so actually the owner, Alistair Dury, I was like buying all these crazy cookbooks and spending all my money at fancy cocktail bars. He said, why don't you just go work in a restaurant, man? Like, what are you doing here? You'll make way more money in restaurants. I was a regular at one particular restaurant. And so I asked him if I could stage in the kitchen. I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a cook or front of house. I kind of figured that no one would want to hire a grumpy barista. You know, I felt I didn't fit the stereotypical server. So I said, hey, can I stage in the kitchen? And they're like, yeah, sure, man. Why don't you come by? So for a month on all my days off, I staged in the kitchen of this restaurant called Refuel, which actually closed that month. So I worked like their last services as a cook. I was never hired there, but put in a few days anyway. And I was hooked. Like the restaurants was like, okay, this is it for sure. Like, that there's no way I'm not working in restaurants going forward. That led to a job at one of their sister restaurants, and I worked there for a couple of years, kind of worked my way up again. Because again, I thought I knew what I was doing. I didn't really. I mean, that kind of ties in a very, very long run into what your initial question was. It was through that job, I started getting a few friends who would taste wine at these events. And they were like importers would pour their new products at a fancy hotel downtown. And it kind of like showcased for buyers and liquor store employees and sommeliers and stuff. And I said, well, I'm into wine. I like wine. You know, like, can I come along? He said, yeah, it's open to anyone. So I started going to those events, tasting everything I possibly could. And that kind of built more and more interest in different wines across the world. I started studying more just on my own, just out of curiosity to learn what I was pouring or what I was tasting. And people started asking me, like, hey, do you buy wine for this restaurant? And I go, no, I'm like the brunch barista. No, man, that's like the owner buys the wine. Eventually I said, hey, like, everybody thinks I'm the buyer for your company. Like, can I start doing that? Like, is that a thing I can do? And there's reasons that eventually did become something I could do. I started buying wine for a restaurant, which is kind of fun.
Was there a moment that you kind of knew you wanted to be in the front of the house over the back of the house? Because, you know, you're working in the kitchen, that restaurant Refuel winds up closing, but it seems like you're headed down that path. But what led to you wanting to just be in the front of the house and be involved in that side of things? Because normally it's everybody that's in the front of the house, they see what's going on in the kitchen and they're like, that looks like a lot of fun. They're like, I stayed in the front of the house because I made more money that way. But like, what was it for you?
So I worked this crazy position at Campino Roma, which was the restaurant, my first restaurant paid gig. So I was a brunch barista, but it also was such a crazy position. We called it bar manger. So it was a bartender and garde manger. So it was this hybrid job that nobody wanted. It was like, I think over the history of that restaurant, only a few people really took to it because bartenders didn't want to touch food and cooks definitely didn't want to serve people. And I was like, well, I kind of want to do both. So like, perfect, you're there. It was crazy. You were online listening to chef for calls for, you know, salads and stuff. You didn't have to prep. The cooks took care of that. But you were also the bartender, the host, like half the time, like the busser. We didn't have any server assistants or anything. So in this like pretty busy, like 40 seat restaurant, you had to hustle all while plating salads and putting up antipasti and stuff like that. It was wild. So I kind of got to live both worlds a little bit. As I kind of honed those skills, I realized that the kitchen life wasn't going to be for me. I like to have the front of house a lot more. I could much more comfortable explaining drinks, wine. At that point, it was more cocktails for me, but also wine and just serving people as I got more comfortable with it. It made a lot more sense to me.
So eventually you wind up going to Campagnolo. You start out as a barman, and then eventually you become the wine director and the bar manager there. So how did you wind up there? And then how do you wind up ascending to this wine director role for the first time in your career?
While at Campagnolo Roma, which is the sister restaurant in the group, Campagnolo was the bigger, like 130 seat, you know, mothership. They had a private dining room that they wanted to change, and they had an idea. The chef owner came back from Charleston. I think he went to like, you know, Sean Brock's house bar way back then. So we had 10 years ago. He's like, I have an idea for a private dining room. So he wanted to change that into a cocktail bar, and he wanted me to run it. We kind of figured out a way. It didn't make sense to have more people than, well, me, I guess, kind of controlling the beverage programs. So I kind of just took over everything for that restaurant. The wine program was kind of just doing its own thing that the GM was taking care of. But having me in the house kind of made more sense because I was trying to stay on top of that stuff a little more than the rest of them. So, yeah, I had some ideas to shore up what they were doing. So I ended up just taking over all the beverage.
When you take over like the wine program and stuff, how did you kind of approach that? Because a lot of people, you know, when they run into an existing wine program, there's a few different philosophies. Most everybody is the wine program has to make sense for the restaurant, has to make money and everything too. But you want to tweak it somehow. There's always something that you feel like when you step into that role, you can kind of improve upon what's already there. So what was your approach? Like, how did you tweak the wine program to kind of fit your style, but also, you know, make it still part of the restaurant?
So this was 2013, I think. So a lot of restaurants, I feel, were kind of transitioning out of, they had been open for a while, transitioning out of kind of lower price value options, kind of premiumizing their offerings in some ways, realizing that people didn't have to have a $6 glass of wine on the wine list, you know, which back then was, that was too cheap in 2013, but kind of looking at the list and saying, hey, I think we make really good food here. We buy from the best farms in the province. We use these organic farmers. We make our own pasta. We cure our meats in house. Like, we should be looking at wineries that do the same. We shouldn't be buying from these big industrial wineries in Italy. So looking at finding producers that were more in line with our kitchen philosophy was a big part of that, for sure. And a bit of that was introducing natural wine back then, which didn't really, it was like one restaurant that had natural wine in Vancouver at that point, and they had just opened, showing a few of those, or putting a few of those on the list to see how people reacted, and that they, you could tell their story, where these wines were much more aligned with our restaurant philosophy.
What was the hardest part about being a wine director for the first time for you? Like, what was the biggest challenge that you had to kind of face and overcome?
Like, piecing everything together by myself, there's a few, just like not having, being self-taught, essentially. The reason why I could kind of step into that role, there's a few managers who had left for various reasons, but there was no real, I was literally shown the office and told, this is the password to the computer. I guess you can look around and see what you can find. So I had to build up my contacts and network in BC from the ground up and figure out how you order things, how it worked, what the timings were like, how much you order without making the boss mad about how much money you spent. And, there's no one, I didn't have a mentor being like, hey, if you spend more than $7,000 this week, like, chef's gonna, do whatever to you. But, and that never happened. But I don't know, I overthink things all the time. So I'm always worried that, you're gonna bankrupt the company, or I swear it's probably not hard to do in restaurants, but too many cases of this wine and you're screwed. Yeah, that was probably the hardest, is like learning the ropes without much guidance at all. I had friends I could ask, but every restaurant's different, so you kind of have to figure it out for yourself.
So somewhere in that time frame too, I think you also discover and start taking some certification exams. You wind up taking the certified sommelier exam with the quartermaster sommeliers. What was kind of the biggest challenge, most difficult part of the exam process for you? Was there one?
A lot of it was just going through it. To be honest, when I started looking into it, it was because I was tired of people asking me what my certification level was. you get asked by guests all the time, like the song documentary had been released and people were really, they're like, oh, are you a sommelier? And I was like, well, it's like a complicated question. And I was like, I'm tired of answering that way. I was just like, sure, I'll go get it. Which is what a friend of mine had done years before. He was just tired of people asking. So he just went and got his WSET level 3. And I think his diploma too is crazy. Yeah, I like them because I studied science. I like studying. I like the academic side of things. I have a huge selection of books at home. Like, any wine book comes out, I'm buying it. That wasn't super difficult. I was really curious to see how difficult these things were. And then I took the intro exam kind of almost on a whim. And I studied for it, but I was over prepared, which was good, and I did quite well on it. But it is, it's a hard questions or something like that, and multiple choice, it's fine. And then I was really worried about certified. I was worried about service because I'd never done formal, fine dining service. And I was primarily a bartender at that point. So just the, mental game of preparing for that was definitely you don't know what they're going to ask you. You don't know what situations they're going to put you in for certifications. So trying to get your head around that. Talk to people who have done it before you, but we don't have a ton of people in Vancouver that have really gone through that process. Now there's quite a bit more, but it's tough. But fortunately passed the first time, which is good.
Was there a particular region during your studies that was more challenging for you than the others?
Yeah, almost the opposite. Like, I had Italy covered, and I like to drink champagne and Burgundy, at least at a basic level. You can study Burgundy as long as you can. It's still going to be challenging, but at least if you know the basics, it's okay. I think like learning about the areas outside of a lot of the classic European wine regions are tough. Like we, like California, South Africa was definitely, I missed all the questions on South Africa in my certified, I think. Australia, I had a bit of interest in. I'm still studying for exams, so there's all kinds of holes in my studies, but you have to keep adding on constantly to keep up with it. So
you're planning on taking the next level, the advanced?
I've written the advanced twice in the last year and a half. It's all kind of been delayed by the pandemic. I was supposed to write in 2020, deferred until last year. I passed all the components except tasting both times. So I have to repeat again next year, but pass tasting this time. So
now you just have to redo like the theory and then the service?
Theory, service, business of wine, and tasting, yeah. The MS exam, you can like just write the components now. If you fail just one, you can just take that component later. But the advanced, to make you take it all in a calendar year, you have to pass all three. So.
Was there a particular reason why you decided on the Court of Master Sommeliers over WSET?
Yep. And actually, it's pretty simple. Price. With WSET, you had to start like lower on the rung than I felt I was at. Like I probably could have just gone in with three and I didn't want to have to take two. I don't have to pay for that and then just be bored in class, which I'm sure I wouldn't have been, but I didn't have a lot of money. So CMS, you could write the intro was like, I don't know, $400 or $600 maybe. And then the certified was only $400 all American. But I looked at that and I went, well, it's self-directed, but I can get certified for a lot less money if I already have kind of a bit of a base of knowledge, then it shouldn't be a problem. I also like that it was tuned to restaurant people. WSET, maybe a little more towards the wine trade, the like merchant side of things, but CMS is very much solidly restaurants, which I liked. A focus on service and more formal hospitality kind of made more sense to me.
So fast forward a little bit, you're working, doing the exams and stuff. And then like 2020, you're named British Columbia's Sommelier of the Year, Vancouver Wine Festival. Was that something that you were expecting to happen? Or was that kind of out of the blue when you hear about this?
Yeah, no, it's funny. The Sommelier of the Year thing, actually, in BC, it used to be like an announced kind of surprise thing. In 2015, the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers, we formed a BC chapter, and they put on an annual competition now that is to find the best sommelier of BC. So that competition is done under the kind of the umbrella of the Association de la Sommelierie Internationale, the International Sommelier Association, the national board, which kind of, it's like a feeder competition for the world's best sommelier competitions. So if you want to compete in that, you have to go through a series of competitions below that put on by your national board. And so that's what this is. And the Wine Fest takes the winner of that as their sommelier of the year. So I won that competition in January before the wine festival, end of February. I knew about it because I went to the competition first.
Like you mentioned, you win the competition like a couple months before that they put on. So Jayton Paul went through it, who's been on this podcast too, and he kind of talked a little bit about it. But how weird is that competition? How strange is it for, you know, a first-time participant? Not just that, but also like any sommelier, because it's done in front of a live audience, right? Like you do the exam portion, you're in a room, so that's fine. And there's like 100 people, everybody goes through the exam, they pick the top three scores off the exam, and then you move on to like this almost like show component where you're doing a service demonstration, you're doing a tasting, you're answering questions in front of a live crowd. Like how weird is that for you going through that?
It's funny. I feel like it's not even that weird. I'll draw a comparison with the barista world. So there's the World Barista Competition, I feel like is a weird competition because you're done and you do this like set where you have to make like four espressos, four cappuccino, and four like signature drinks that involve espresso as a beverage, and you perform that for judges in front of a live audience. I'm like, that's not, it's like close to what you do. It's like close to what you do in cafes and barista, but it's not really what you do. And it's like become this like fully like encapsulated like performance for people. Like it's like rhythmic gymnastics for baristas. The sommelier competitions actually kind of are what you do in a restaurant, which I like. It's like a simulation. You go to a big table. They want you to decant this magnum of really expensive wine that they brought in for corkage, but it's like they want you to do something weird with it. And it's not really different from what you would do in a restaurant every night. We're like, oh, here's the champagne. And I'm like, oh, we actually have like 10 other people joining us. You need to buy this bottle like equally into 10 glasses for us. And can you suggest pairings to go with this dinner menu that we have tonight? And it was weird in that you had not seen that menu before anyone else had. So you look at the screen and you go, okay, like, what am I going to pair with this? So there's usually some sort of limits as to what you can do for pairing. Like, I think in my year, you had to pair a 5-course menu with all sparkling wine, all from France, and you couldn't repeat an appellation. Like, it had to all be different for each course. They do fun, like, I don't know. I love Jeopardy, like, trivia shows and stuff. So they'll do things like they show a slideshow of photos of wine people or vineyards or, like, obscured bottles, and you have to, like, say what's in the photo, and you only have 12 seconds to identify it. Yeah, I don't know. I actually think it's kind of fun, but definitely it's nerve-wracking for sure. Definitely stressful.
You were the last to go out of the three, right? Was that more stressful, like having to sit around and wait? Because like you guys are in your own private room, you can't like watch anybody, right? So did that heighten kind of the anxiety and stress for you? And like you would have rather gone first?
I almost feel like if I had gone first, I don't know if my blood pressure and heart rate would have come down in time. In third, I mean, the year I did it, it took place at Rogers Arena, like where the Vancouver Canucks play hockey. And so I was given a private suite in the arena just by myself. I think I wore a pathway around a little coffee table in the carpet because I was pacing around it so much. I don't know. You just kind of have to get it over with at some point. But yeah, it was a long few hours for sure.
What was the reason you decided to enter? Was it just you wanted to see where you were at compared to kind of other people in the city in your field, or you just wanted to learn more, or just wanted to practice? Or
there was a little bit. I had been in the competition a few times before. I had never made the finals prior to that. There was a bit of peer pressure, or like the people who organized it would be like, Peter, you should compete this year. I'm like, nah, I'm not good enough to win that. Like, don't. Like, I'm not going to do that. And I'm like, no, you should just do it. And so I think it was early on. First winner was a very good friend of mine. So I was there to like support him in his first year they did it. And I saw kind of how it changed his career path. Then in future years, like, Peter, you should really do this. But I don't know. I remember there was a seminar they put on with a woman named Veronique Rivest, who owns a wine bar in Quebec. And she won second in the world, maybe 2012, very highly regarded. And she did she was like there to kind of promote the idea of the competition. But the way she talked about it got me to think about it a little differently. It was like a way to challenge yourself and a way to better yourself professionally by kind of staying on top of what's current. I mean, I don't want to be kind of stagnant, right? Or you can stagnate. This kind of gets you to stay on current wine news and what's going on in the world of wine and other beverage, not rest, which is good. So after she did that seminar, I was like, yeah, okay, I should give it a try. The exam was really hard, so I did not do well the first couple of years. Yeah, I was successful the first time I got through the finals, which was really nice.
What makes the exam harder than the advanced exam that you're taking? Like, what's the biggest difference? Is it more essay writing versus kind of multiple choice question type stuff? Or
they have the ASI puts out like a guide for what the exam should look like a little bit, but they do it to competition exams are written to be differentiators where it should like weed out most of the people who, and it'll clarify who the people are in the candidate pool. Whereas at least in the advanced exam, you would hope for a reasonable level of success. Like the competition side just gets so obscure. Like, let's say like a good score is 30-40% for like a winner. Well, that's what their score will be because they just try and find the most obscure bits of knowledge or complicated wine science stuff or whatever. You're just trying to score points, not necessarily pass as a competitor.
So it's like a different mindset. Like, it's almost like you're playing a game. How do you improve your odds almost kind of thing?
Yeah, because there's no way you're going to predict what they're going to put on, whereas at least in like certifications, I mean, again, the CMS doesn't tell you a lot either about what's going to be on the exam. So you, but at least you kind of know it's going to be the classic regions and classic questions and information that makes sense to sell wine in a restaurant. The competition is like, all that's out the window. It's like everything is fair game. They're going to ask you about like locations of vineyards in China and like where or what the parentage of like really obscure grapes are. And you just have to hope that you know one or two, you know, like it's not, you're not going to get 100%. You're not going to get 50% really.
Did you wind up going on and competing in the next level, the one across Canada?
Yeah, in 2021, they put on a Canadian national competition and I competed in that and I didn't make the finals there. It's complicated because they make you compete in a second language internationally and nationally. So I had to give it a fair shake in French, although the preliminaries, it just made us do a little bit of service in French, but that makes it like another level of difficult. If you make the finals, you have to do it entirely in a non-mother tongue. So for us Anglophones here, we have to speak French. I think you can choose Spanish if you choose, but that makes you hire an interpreter, but those are the international rules. So that's how it goes. But yeah, I competed there. It was great fun. Master Sommelier Pierre Alexis Soulier won that one. And a colleague at one of my study buddies came in second. So it was like a very high performance for a Western Canadian, Matthew Landry. And I'm preparing for the 2023 Nationals. It's actually, I'm leaving in 5 days for the Nationals. So one more kick at the can for me.
Since you competed before, did you have to go back through the BC thing, or do you get like multiple invites into the national one? 3 years you can compete or something before it like runs out.
Yeah, I think they're trying to figure that out. Once you've won your credentials, I don't think you're allowed to compete again. And it's the same nationally. Like once you've won nationals, you can't compete again. I was under the impression we're kind of indefinitely qualified for the nationals, but it seems like as the competitions go on more, they become kind of bigger events. And so this year they're limiting the candidates to 3 per provincial chapter. I don't know if I'll be able to compete nationally again, but we'll see. I'm curious about that. It doesn't make sense to kind of limit people to like 1 or 2 attempts. So I've got some people to get a tattoo.
Did you know any French prior, or did you have to learn it all?
Yeah, I mean, they teach French in Canadian schools I took it until graduation for high school. I can read it fairly well. My speaking and my comprehension isn't great, but that's what I've been working on this year. So I think I know enough to be able to, I can do the finals comfortably enough now, I think.
When you win, you know, best sommelier, what did that mean to you at the moment? And then kind of looking back on it, what does it mean to you now? Does it carry the same meaning as it did then, or is it different now?
Yeah, it was huge for me then. Like, it was like a nice validation of a lot of the work I had put in. And because I had a lot of people help me out, but I still feel like I've never really had a lot of direct mentors. I didn't go and work for the best, you know, sommeliers in BC, or I haven't staged Michelin star restaurants or whatever else. So to win that without doing a lot of that and kind of just, you know, working up from books and just the work in a restaurant meant a lot. And to do it, you know, in front of my peers who I respect a lot, and like with the crew that we have in Vancouver, it's an amazing community here, like really amazing, really generous sommeliers. It felt really good. Unfortunately, like 2 months later, the pandemic hit, and like I think my bar at the time we were just named Canada's top 50 bars. And like a week later, the pandemic started, and my restaurant closed, never reopens. I had to find a new. Well, I was on employment insurance for 4 months, you know, so it took the wind out of my sails pretty quickly. I still haven't been able to use a lot of the stuff that I like that I won that year, just because a lot of it was travel related, which kind of, it would be easy to feel sorry for myself, but it's almost at this point, it's almost irrelevant. You know, transitioning to a really amazing restaurant group and put some hard work in. And yeah, I think all in all, it's better. I think the opportunity may not have existed if I didn't win that competition, the career opportunities, that is. And yeah, it kind of changed, I think, how I'm perceived a little bit in the industry. It's still a really cool title. I tell all like young sommeliers all the time, they've got to try and go for it. You know, like, what do they have to lose?
So yeah, the place you wound up, as you kind of alluded to, Bar Gobo, and you kind of join as, the GM sommelier there too as well. How involved were you with the group, Burdock and Co. group, in getting the property opening and running? Did they ask for your input on kind of way things were going to be arranged? Because, I mean, they have a couple restaurants, right? But every time you open something new, it's something different. I can't imagine that anybody's trying to rule out some advice or some opinions from somebody who's been in the industry too much, though I'm sure some places do that. So how involved were you with getting the property up and running and getting it to where it is now?
I had known Andrew and Kevin for a long time from Burdock. I was a regular there. It was my favorite restaurant in the city before I started working for them. And they have this space beside our other spot called Harvest. And they were going to initially move their kind of food service idea from Harvest over to this new space. But that's when the pandemic hit. So they realized, probably splitting your existing business in half didn't make a lot of sense. And they weren't sure what to do with the new spot. And they had the lease signed. At the time, the GM of Burdock, another friend of mine, Jesse, he sent me a message. And he said, hey, I've got kind of an interesting idea for you. This is in July of 2020. Not a lot's going on in restaurants. And he says, I might have a new idea for you. And so we met up, Burdock folks. And some laws have loosened here about maybe doing a... you could sell bottles of wine to go here, which was never really a thing. We have very strict liquor laws here in BC. And the government said, yeah, you can do this now with a takeout food. You can serve bottles of wine. And a lot of places just started selling bottles. They weren't really enforcing the rules at the time. And so why don't we open up a little bottle shop? We can just run a little wine shop down in Chinatown. So yeah, that sounds cool. But why don't we make it like a wine? Let's serve wine too. Let's look at a food program. And they go, yeah, okay, we've got some ideas. And looked a little harder at the restaurant is very small. It's 400, like just over 400 square feet. We don't have food vents or ventilation. So it very much limits what we can do in the kitchen. We've got now 20 seats. Back then we had 12 seats. Because of social distancing. Well, I haven't said that in a long time. And so, and 12 seats, I know it's not a lot, but we can run this space with like almost no people. As myself, a chef, and I had a server, we'll open for 4 days a week and we'll just see what happens. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, then whatever, no big deal. But we have no storage, so I was like, I don't need to be a bottle shop. Maybe we're just a restaurant, just like a wine bar. We'll see if we can make the wine bar thing happen. And long story short, the wine bar, more a restaurant, actually, the restaurant. No dishwasher, no host, no server assistants. Like, it was me, a chef, and a server. So pretty small crew to run out of space. I mean, not a lot of seats, really, so you don't need a lot of people.
With the wine list, almost the entire wine list that you've created is available by the glass or by the bottle, which is not normally the case. Normally it's, you have a little section for by the glass and everything else kind of by the bottle. But I think there's only like 7 reserve bottles or something that are strictly only available by the bottle. So with incorporating kind of having that double-edged sword, being able to do both for most of the selections, does that change kind of how you approach the wine list and what you put on there? Knowing that maybe you could put something on there more expensive or something like that, and if it doesn't move bottle wise, you could do it, by the glass, and it'll make up margins, or vice versa.
Yeah, I have a lot of flexibility here. They kind of let me do what I see fit, so which is great. I kind of buy wine. It has to be delicious. I do look for bottles to be stable. We pour a lot of natural wine here, but if it's going to be one of those wines that turns in half hour, I'm probably not interested in putting it on the list. Maybe it'll get a reserve listing if it's really good wine, but generally not. I use the Coronin all the time. I'm probably one of Coronin's best customers at this point. I spend way too much on Argonne. But yeah, I noticed this, like, even before the pandemic, like, restaurants were restricting their glass doors. And then the pandemic hit, and like, you'd go to restaurants and there'd be like one or two wines by the glass. Like, oh, we got a house red and a house white, but no glass pours. I love varieties. So I wanted to be a place, despite being so small, I wanted to have a large variety of wines so that people could try a bunch of different things and experiment with wine and try and like explore and discover new things that they've never tried before. Because even though I might know a lot of the wines on the list, and I wrote the list, so hopefully I know them, most people walk in and they're like, I have no idea what this is. And if you talk to some traditional sommeliers, they don't really like that so much. They would say, well, you should have a California cab, or you should have some familiarity. But because we're such a small place, I'm always on the floor. I'm always there to guide people. So trying to make it not pretentious, try to meet people wherever they're at in their wine journey, because it's all, you know, everyone's at a different place. And just trying to find the right glass for them. And that's what, you know, by having almost, I think counting the other day, 29 wines by the glass, helps people feel more comfortable. And usually I find something that they're into.
When you're adding new wines to the list, is there anything specifically that you're looking for? Like, obviously it has to taste good, but are you trying to figure out, like, will it pair with something that's on the upcoming menu, or if it fits a certain price point, or if it's local, or like, what's your like criteria for adding something to the list eventually?
I like a mix of local wines and international. I skew international, because most of my guests are local, and a lot of, we drink all in BC here. We don't export much, so most of my locals are savvy enough. They kind of go, I've had that already, or oh, I'm on the wine club list, like. So I don't bother with that as much, but I like to highlight some of the best that we have here. I like looking at viticulture. So I like producers who are organic, biodynamic, regenerative, the new term that a lot of people are talking about. I like when wine is the produce of farming, like when they're kind of upfront about being farmers. Like, it's not like if you go to a website or a winery and it's like all glossy, like, luxury stuff, I'm probably not interested. Like, but if they're talking about, you know, like, oh, I'm the fifth generation farmer of this land, and like, we grow wine and we don't, you know, we don't make it or whatnot, it is a lot more interesting to me. Or if they have a polyculture farm where they're like, oh, like, wine is just a part of what we do, but we also grow hazelnuts and olives, and we cure our own meats with the animals that we keep here. Those are the kind of wines I'm always kind of looking at what pairs with the menu as well, but I'm less keen about that. I kind of feel like pairing is a less than perfect science. And so if you kind of find a balanced wine, if you have a balanced dish, you can kind of make a lot of things work depending on your perspective. But yeah, I mean, I like wines of delicacy, and our menu tends towards that anyway. So it kind of ends up working out, which is good. Yeah, I don't know. What else do I look for? I kind of have in those like 30 wines approximately by the glass, I kind of have categories. So they might not seem like it, but, you know, I just replaced like a Loire Valley Sauvignon Blanc with a Firmenz from Hungary. That's kind of like tart, somewhat herbaceous, somewhat mineral wine. You know, like, that swap worked. I didn't replace it with like a really full-bodied oak-aged white wine. To kind of have stuff on deck that can replace in style what's already on the menu.
So for you, like, what part of being a sommelier is the most fun for you?
I think the never-ending pursuit of, like, not only knowledge, but of flavor and, like, what bottles are out there. Like, you can never learn it all, ever. Like, it's an infinite amount of information out there that, yeah, it's just, it never ends. You can always be surprised. Like, it's easy to make full statements about things or like broad statements. Like, as a young guy, I think it's all super Tuscans are horrible Like, that's such a stupid thing to say, you know? Like, it's obviously, I found Super Tuscans that are amazing now. Like, I regret saying that as a youth. But I was just, like, looking at, I don't know, like, $25 cheap, like, wines that, I don't know, they still serve a purpose, but they're garbage. And there's definitely not very, like, oh, man, there's some delicious wines. But these things you say when you don't know what you're saying, you know?
When you get the chance to go out when you're not working, do you compulsively check the wine list when you go to a restaurant, or are you able to just disassociate and just kind of enjoy the experience?
Probably a better question for my partner. Because I would say, oh, no, definitely no. I'd probably look at the wine list for a bit. But also, I mean, I go out less now than I used to. And so if I'm going to go out for wine, I'm going to go to a place that probably has a good list already. So that's the competition mindset. Like looking at wine lists and trying to find mistakes and although I would never point them out unless it was like a close friend. But yeah, I spend a bit of time with the list. I like seeing what's out there, what little, you know, good bottles they might have for whatever price or occasion, you know.
Is there a wine region that you gravitate towards? You know, I feel like everybody has this one, for whatever reason, that's the one that kind of sucked them into the world of wine, whether it's Bordeaux or Burgundy or, you know, what have you. So do you have a specific wine, specific region that is kind of your favorite?
Yeah, the Mosel Valley in Germany. I hate that I'm that like stereotypical sommelier who likes Riesling, you know, but yeah, I can't help it. Cabernet Riesling, I could drink that all the time and be happy. Definitely a Desert Island wine. I haven't been. I was supposed to go in 2020. But man, yeah, those wines for me, and it's a disappearing style. It's not very popular. People are, well, at least in North America, people are afraid of sweetness, and they shouldn't be because it's a fruit. And those wines are just light and ethereal and really delicious.
Is there a region that you're excited to kind of focus on in the future, whether it's through studying or something that you can incorporate into the bar?
I feel like I want to, at some point, master Burgundy and Champagne. And like Champagne, I feel like, is going through more of an evolution now. Burgundy is kind of figuring itself out. I can't afford it. So that'll be reading. Champagne, I can at least afford a little bit sometimes. I don't know. There's just like, I have, you know, copies of these amazing books like on Burgundy by Justin Morris, like Peter Lee's Champagne books, and there's just like such a huge amount of history, lore, complexity that is documented that's really cool. I feel like a lot of that can exist in other wine regions, but there it's like been that way for a long time. And it's, I don't know, just to be able to like parse through a really big Burgundy list would be. And like to know exactly, like to be that guy who's like, okay, I know exactly where these vineyards are, how they behave, and like what the family lineage is of every producer, because man, those family trees get crazy.
What do you think is the next wine region to explode, to, you know, become super popular, and unfortunately probably along with popularity go drastically up in price? But is there anything that you kind of see and stuff that you're drinking or stuff that you encounter through competitions or wine buying that you're like, oh, that's pretty interesting what they're doing over there?
Huh. There's a lot of wine regions probably poised to do this. I think Austria has a, and that's just a personal thing too, like for dry Riesling and Grüner Veltliner, like they have probably an unlimited level of potential there. But again, I don't know if it'll catch on because the labels are complicated for us English speakers. And, not everybody understands Riesling, which is fine. If it keeps the price down for me, I'm very happy for that. I think like Etna in Sicily has definitely had this huge like rise recently, but I think they as well, like the way they're figuring out their contratas, like single vineyard sites. And I was just looking at the price for Benanti's Pietra Marina, their white, and like that's like tripled in price in the last few years here, which is great. I mean, it's amazing wine, but it's crazy to see that. Yeah, I think some of the outer reaches of California too, like we'll probably see a little more respect, like Oregon as well. They're already up there, but at least up here, I don't know, we don't see it quite as much. Maybe, yeah, there's a lot that can happen in wine for sure.
What's next for you professionally? You're getting ready, I guess, to, you mentioned the advanced exams, right? You're working towards that. You got the Canadian competition that you're working towards too as well. Obviously running the bar there and everything too as well. But anything else you got coming up on the horizon or anything outside of that stuff?
Yeah, that's kind of taken over most of the, as soon as this competition is done, I can stop focusing on French and I'll flip over to theory. Yeah, so make sure I can keep that up. And then, I'm on the floor every day that we're open. So balancing that and the exam schedules is more than a full-time job. So yeah, I don't have no crazy wine plans. Just trying to make this place as good as I can.
So this next question comes from the previous guest on the podcast, sommelier Kelly Ford Lau of Kelly Somm in Las Vegas, Nevada. She left behind for you. Where do you see technology continuing to benefit your industry?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's funny because we get like cold calls for like, here's this next AI tool that'll shore up your ticket business. And I'm not interested. We don't do any ticket. I feel like that is not the future. I think there'll be more tools. You see a little bit of like there's tools for buyers to kind of manage their inventories that are more reasonable, I guess. I think for like restaurant business, like better reservation systems and the way like certain reservation systems tweak things, that'll help restaurants. I don't know. I'm kind of a bit of an old school guy though. Like when it comes to, I love technology, but I feel like restaurants are this kind of last bastion of like, you can't get a robot to do it. AI is not going to generate recipes for you. I was going to say, can't replace the sommelier, but man, Vivino tries hard to do that. You know, they're not going to make the choices to buy wine for a restaurant. So I don't know. I feel like a lot of it is just canceling wines and not a really technological thing. But I'm also a tiny restaurant with printed paper menus. Like it's not.
It sounds like you think probably more on the back end, like stuff customers really won't see, where it's organizational tools probably.
Yeah, for customers, I don't know. But I could just be really short-sighted. I'm sure there's people working on tools that'll be mind-blowing in 10 years,
What's a question you want to leave behind for the next guest?
It's like, how can regulations be opened up to help you do business better as a restaurateur or somebody or whatever?
Next question comes from one of our listeners. They wrote in, if you had to move to a different city but still work in your current profession, your current position, which city would you pick? So you've been kicked out of Vancouver, but you still have to work as a sommelier and a bar manager. What city are you going to?
New York, San Francisco, or London. Either three. New York would probably be tops, though. If I could get a green card, that would work. Yeah, I love New York. Love all three of those cities. Yeah, they'd all be amazing. Like great centers for the wine world, good bars, good access to products.
So this last set of questions we asked to everybody who comes on the podcast, so a nice compare and contrast across all the episodes for the listeners. First question, who would you say is the biggest influence on your career when you look back on it?
Probably the chef owner of Campagnolo, probably Robert Belcher, probably influenced me the most, yeah.
What is your desert island wine?
JJ Prune, Velliner, Zominer, Cabinet, any vintage.
Restaurant you'd recommend that isn't your own. So scenario I give, person gets stuck at the airport, flight canceled, can't get out till the next morning. You guys aren't open, but they reach out to you. Hey, where should we go eat?
I mean, I'd say our sister restaurant, Burdock & Co., but that's cheating. If you're flying from somewhere else, I go to like Chef's Choice, which is like a high-end Cantonese place. If they could sneak in dim sum for during the day. Yeah, that's if you're on a layover in Vancouver, you gotta eat some good Chinese food.
Bucket list travel destination, bucket list restaurant. So a place you have not visited yet, you still want to travel to, and then a restaurant you have not dined at, but you still want to get to one day.
Well, it's got to be like the Mosel Valley would be, I have to go there. Restaurants, there's so many. It'd have to be like, I'm stuck in 10 years ago. It'd probably be like Echebarri in Spain. Yeah, I think probably Echebarri.
Craziest thing you've seen happen in a restaurant while you're working?
Oh, there's so many. I had a guy roll into my bar after way after last call. Like, I was just about to lock up the door. Like, the place was kind of hidden. You had to know that the door would open to a place. And he crawled up the stairs. I looked like the kind of a normal guy. And he goes, "Oh, is this the Brazzers party? He's like, "It's the porno party, right?" And I was like, "What? No, dude, you gotta get out of here." I was like, "Nah, this is the place. They told me to come here." I was like, "No, you gotta get out of here, man." And so we just sat down on the top stairs, we're upstairs. And he's like, "Well, at least let me tell you about my day." And I was like, "I wish I could, man, but you gotta get out of here." It was a little more drawn out than that. That other guy who walked through the whole restaurant in a hospital gown, like with like blood on him, that was good. He snuck in past the host. We didn't know what to do with him.
Food or drink guilty pleasure. Is there anything fast food, candy, whatever that you know is kind of unhealthy for you, but you just can't help yourself?
Oh, God. I'm not the best person to ask for that. Potato chips are the reason why I'm a big guy. That's potato chips are the worst and the best.
So this next one, we broke into four kind of mini sections here. So it's wine recommendations. So things that you think people should be drinking, you know, outside of the normal stuff that they always gravitate towards. So we broke it into a couple different price points. So bottle $0 to $20 retail, $0 to $50, $0 to $100, and then over $100, no limit. So if you have three that all happen to be under $20, you know, you can slot them into those kind of first 3 points if you want. But $0 to $20, what's something that you think people should be looking for when they're out buying wine the next time? You know, get a lot of bang for your buck, something that they should try.
Under $20, your best bang for your buck is probably from Portugal, just in general, but like a bottle of like Vinho Verde, just like a light sparkling. I mean, it could be red, but generally the whites, semi-sparkling, sometimes off dry, but like the dry classic ones, like we can, even in BC with crazy, our wine prices are so high. Like $20 is a tough, under 20 can be tough here sometimes. You can get bottles for like $12 or $13 that are absolutely delicious. There's, yeah, really over delivers for value for sure.
Zero to 50 for a bottle.
Beaujolais is going to still fit in that, I think. It's getting close where good Beaujolais is over that here in our market. But like cru Beaujolais at like $40 is going to be so delicious almost every time. I know it's a cliche sommelier recommendation, but it's, yeah, so good. Light, crunchy red, always.
0 to 100.
And we talked a lot about Riesling, but I would say champagne, like good grower champagne. Like in our market here, you'll probably laugh, but like Veuve Clicquot is like $72 a bottle, I think. And so you can pay even at a private shop like $80 for a bottle of amazing, like biodynamically grown grower champagne that will be so much better than your, I mean, and no knock against Veuve, hey, it has its place. Yeah, what's my current producer that I love? Mouzon LaRue, Champagne Mouzon LaRue. They're amazing, like cool, like Solera age wines that I can get for under $100 here.
And then over 100, no real limit.
What could you buy over $100? I mean, there's so many things. You're probably overpaying. You know what? I'll say this. Vintage port. People don't drink enough vintage port these days. And it's causing it to disappear from shelves. I remember walking in and asking a liquor store, a wine shop, and they knew me, but I was like, "Hey, what do you have for vintage port?" And they laughed. They're like, "The last time we sold a bottle of that, you weren't even born," which is obviously a lie, but there's like no motivation for people to have it on the shelf. If nobody buys it. So it's expensive, but those wines, when you age them, they're like, they really are special.
What is one book focused on beverage you think everyone should read?
Terry Deese's Reading Between the Vines. That would be a good one. That's like a really interesting like monologue, essentially, like grower champagne and Riesling, and like why he buys the wines he did when he had his import agency. It's kind of like a modern Kermit Lynch, Adventures on the Wine Route, which also is kind of in that category. Yeah, anyone interested in beverage should read those. It's like really cool.
Lastly, I'm an Anthony Bourdain fan, but not everybody is or was. If you were, is there a moment, episode, scene that still stands out to you about him? If you weren't, is there anybody else who's on TV culinary personality, Emeril, Julia Child, somebody that you always kind of gravitated towards?
I'm in the Bourdain camp with you right there for sure. There's a lot. The layover, I think. I like them all, but the layover episode where he goes to London and hangs out with Fergus Henderson is like, I don't know, that's like quintessential Bourdain for me. That or any of his episodes in Japan were pretty amazing episodes, I think. Yeah, no real scenes. Maybe the one where he hangs out, the last one he did in Japan, Parts Unknown, like hangs out on the coast. It's like very zen. That was a beautiful episode.
Where can people find you? Social media, website, plug everything.
I am on Instagram, Peter_Van, V-A-N. Website is petervan.ca, although I haven't updated that in a while. That's probably my most, Peter_Van for most things. And Bargobo, bar.gobo on Instagram, bargobo.com.
Bargobo is open Wednesday through Saturday, 5 to 10. And then reservations on Talk for that. Now, this is awesome. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking about your career and all the competition stuff too as well. It's always it's still like when I hear about all the stuff that you guys do in that competition, it's just kind of wild. Vancouver's an awesome place. A lot of great hospitality industry professionals up there. We've had a handful on the podcast, and it's always great to have somebody on from Vancouver. You guys really care about the industry, and it kind of just shows in conversation. So always cool to connect with you guys. Otherwise, best of luck at the competition, upcoming exam for next year too as well. But stay in touch. If you ever need anything from us, let us know. Always try and support everybody as much as we can who helps support us and comes on the podcast. But can't wait to come back. And when we do, definitely be stopping in, saying hi, and having a glass of wine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you're ever up here, let me know. It'll be fun.
Big thanks again to Peter for coming on the podcast, taking some time out of his day to jump on, talk about his career, going through the competition circuit, what he's got going on now too as well, his time at Bargobo, how he approaches the wine menu and everything. So again, you can follow him on Instagram. It's @Peter_VAN and also @bar.gobo. It's G-O-B-O. Those are the two places that you could find him. Check us out on Instagram too as well. We're @SpoonMob. We're on all the other social media. Either it's @SpoonMob or @SpoonMob1. TikTok, Facebook, all that stuff. A lot of it's linked to itself or to the other platforms, but we usually try and put out a TikTok post like Wednesday night, a few hours before the podcast episode drops, so people can kind of get a feel for who the guest is and what the topic's going to be kind of thing. So you can check us out there. Check out the website, spoonmob.com. Like I mentioned at the top, different profiles for everybody, contact information, food photos, wine photos, all that stuff, contact portal where you can reach us with questions, comments, feedback. You want to submit a question to get featured on an upcoming episode with a chef or a sommelier or whatever, do so. We'll incorporate it as soon as we can. Let you know what episode and guest that is incorporated with, so you can keep an eye out for and kind of be part of the podcast that way. Is kind of a through line. So that is it for this week. Appreciate everybody who's been listening. If you're new here, welcome. If you've been here for a while, thank you for your continued support. We've been very heavy in kind of the wine stuff lately. That's just by scheduling default. We reach out to a bunch of different people. This time of year, kind of when you get to the fall holiday season, there's a lot of different one-off special events that are happening at different restaurants, chef guest dinners, collaborations, wine dinners, all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of really hard to book people for the podcast just because of their schedule over the course of kind of end of October and then beginning of kind of the Christmas week. Everything is just kind of jacked up. So wine folks have been kind of the easiest to book with stuff that they have going on and been able to make time, where chefs are probably a little bit busy with the restaurant and some guest dinners and everything coming up. So that's why we've been kind of heavy on the wine section. That's really the only reason, not an agenda or anything like that. I do enjoy talking to a bunch of the wine professionals and get their kind of compare and contrast styles across the episodes and everything. But we aren't for any reason, outlawing any chefs coming on or anything like that. It's just kind of the way it's worked out. So We do have some upcoming episodes with some chefs, so we get back into that kind of that format too as well. But yeah, appreciate everybody who's been listening. Continue to help spread the word too as well. But thank you for your continued support, and we will talk to you guys next week on Thursday.